Hello, I'm Charles Litonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll hear from prominent Ugandan designer Latif Madoy, who spent over 6 weeks in detention. And could Tunisian-born Ons Jabeur, who was the runner-up at Wimbledon 2022 and 2023, become the first woman to bring the trophy home?
I felt a little bit sad coming here, but obviously Wimbledon is my favorite tournament. I love being here. I love the crowd. I love the amazing court. So hopefully just going to bring me so much joy, and really grateful that I have another opportunity to participate at Wimbledon again. And I will take it point by point, set by set, and hopefully match by match.
It's Monday, July 1st. We begin in South Africa. If you've been following South African politics, you may know that incumbent President Cyril Ramaphosa was sworn in for a second term as president of the country recently. But it wasn't thanks to voter endorsement of his party, the well-known and oldest liberation party in Africa, the African National Congress, ANC in short. In fact, the ANC lost its parliamentary majority in the May 29th elections. It's a first defeat for them since a historic win in South Africa's first democratic elections in 1994. Since losing, this time round, the ANC has been forced, if you like, into forming a coalition government with its main rival, the Democratic Alliance, DA, and the Inkatha Freedom Party, IFP, but also including some other smaller parties. Many headlines have described this as a new era for South Africa. While coalition rule is not unusual in South African countries, the makeup of South Africa's coalition is unusual because of how different the parties are, a fact acknowledged by President Ramaphosa after unveiling his new cabinet.
These men and women that we have appointed to the executive are drawn from all corners of our country. They reflect the diversity of our nation. They have a responsibility to work together to serve the people of South Africa as a whole. None of the members of the National Executive has been appointed to serve the interests of a particular constituency, a particular party, or a particular section of society. Collectively and individually, they are responsible to the people of South Africa.
For more on this, I've been speaking to South African journalist Virashni Pillay. Virashni, thank you and welcome to the Focus on Africa podcast.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So let's start with who makes up this coalition government that we've heard about from South Africa in the last few hours.
So making up the coalition government that we've just heard about from South Africa is, of course, the Democratic Alliance that was previously our opposition party, along with the Inkatha Freedom Party. The Democratic Alliance has 6 ministerial posts, the IFP has 2 posts, and then there are a couple of other smaller parties that have gotten 1 post each, and that's the Patriotic Alliance, GUD, which has been in the cabinet before, and the Freedom Front Plus.
Right. And what are South Africans saying about this new cabinet?
There's a lot of excitement at the moment because with alternatives to this cabinet would have been a tie-up with the MK party led by former President Jacob Zuma or with the very radical EFF party led by Julius Malema. Now, both those parties would not have been good for the economy. It would have really tanked the economy, spooked investors, leaned towards irresponsible financial policies that would have seen things like printing money and hyperinflation, amongst other problems. So a lot of South Africans are really relieved that we have avoided that sort of catastrophic scenario. And looking on with interest, I mean, there was a lot of bun fights ahead of this being announced about who would get what positions. So the news just landed last night and everyone's sort of going through it. I think a lot of South Africans are taken aback at how big the cabinet is. It's 32 ministers. That's a really large amount. And about a third of those are not from the ANC.
Yeah, you said the MK party and the EFF would have led to some sort of a economic catastrophe. Is that a view that majority South Africans hold? Or whose view is it?
Yeah, I've got to say that the majority of South Africans probably do not hold that view. They probably see this as, I wouldn't say majority, but many people, including MK party supporters and EFF supporters, probably think that this is a conspiracy, what I'm saying right now, right? Because this is the view of the markets. This is the view of economists. This is the view of independent analysts. This is the view of people who are pro the constitution. And quite frankly, pro a sort of maybe more neoliberal order of things, which I can understand a lot of South Africans are not happy with. They haven't seen the gains of democracy. There is huge problems of unemployment, inequality and poverty. It is crippling communities. So a lot of people are saying, this looks like more of the same. How is this going to change my lived reality? And a lot of people saying, you know, why should we think that the DA is going to do better than the MK party? And of course, explaining those economics and finance can get really complex to people to say, let's grow the economy. And of course, we can't promise that there'll be a trickle-down effect to the bottom. So we have to do better. We have to grow the economy in an inclusive way and include those at the bottom who are going to vote for the EFF and MK party because they're not seeing a change in their lives.
You did mention that 32 ministers, there are 43 deputy ministers. Is the feeling in South Africa that this will be a bloated government, a bloated cabinet?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of voters are especially feeling the pinch because these people get paid huge amounts of money and we're living in a very tough economic space. So why are we paying so much for additional ministers? And the parties that have joined the government of national unity, most notably the DA, have long complained about cabinet being too bloated, but are now part of this bloated cabinet. And then in their kind of negotiations ahead of this was part of that, right? So Ramaphosa said at the beginning of his speech, I had hoped to bring down the number of cabinet ministers, but I could not. Essentially, that's what he said. So if you think about the fact that Mandela had 27 ministers and we're now sitting with 32, that's quite a big number. I mean, it rose dramatically under Zuma. He had 35 ministers and it became a way to reward his allies, which really is not what cabinet should be about. And it does feel a little bit that that's what it has become. Everybody wants a position to say that they are part of the government of national unity, but it really should be about serving South Africa.
Do you think maybe this is because of the fact that you have more people now claiming a piece of this cake? Therefore, the cake needs to be expanded a bit. Are there people that see it like that?
So absolutely, people do see it like that, that everybody wants a piece of the cake, the ministerial cabinet cake. And that is a pity. I don't think people are tolerating it, but they are kind of reluctantly accepting it because it is just the way it is. And quite frankly, anything is better than what we've had. When I say anything, I mean new blood, fresh voices. And it's kind of ridiculous to have so many ministerial positions. But if you think about how much we're losing from incompetence, it's a drop in the ocean to have another ministerial position. We're losing billions because of the crisis at Transnet and our ports, because of the crisis at Eskom, which is getting slowly better. So we need good people to grow our economy. And if that means keeping some parties happy so we can get good people into government, so be it. This is politics. We have to be pragmatic.
And maybe you can talk us through the different parties. You did mention, of course, at the beginning of the interview, the ANC, the DA, and a few others. What do they stand for? And what is it that they will be bringing into this government now that they all have to work together?
So all the parties in the government of national unity are constitutionally minded, largely centrist parties. And that was intentional. When they announced the government of national unity, they very specifically said, we are inviting parties that respect the constitution and the rule of law, because there are parties who want to change the constitution in ways that are not tenable. The MK party has been very clear that they want to scrap the constitution, do away with it, and give power to traditional leaders. The EFF party want to go towards a kind of radical socialism. So the parties that we have there now, the DA is probably the most right, but they're still a centrist party. They believe in sort of, you know, markets. They're very pro-business, pro-market kind of party. They can be very conservative fiscally, and they have been accused of not doing enough for poorer communities and underspending in poorer communities in the areas where they've governed. Then you have the Inkatha Freedom Party, who's doing really well under its new leader. Of course, their leader, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, passed away, a very historical party, traditionally a Zulu party, but they've come to really be the adult in the room. They were the third sort of founding member of the government of national unity, and they were really kind of trying to keep the peace while the DA and the ANC were fighting over positions ahead of the announcement. And they've come across as a really strong voice these days. And they've come across as a real voice of reason, especially in KwaZulu-Natal, where Zuma's party has a huge foothold. And the IFP is the reason that this coalition is going to be able to keep KwaZulu-Natal, a really key province that has really suffered from poor governance. So the other two parties, or three parties, is the Freedom Front Plus, a very conservative Afrikaans party that exists to sort of protect Afrikaans rights, really. They've got correctional services, which includes prisons. Then there is Patricia de Lille, kind of old hand in South African politics. Her party, Good, is remaining in tourism. And then Patriotic Alliance, a little bit of a populist party, a bit of an outlier in this bunch in terms of policy, I would say. They can be quite populist in their rhetoric. They got the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture.
If we are to look at then the ANC, there are people within the ANC that were not happy or comfortable with the fact that they had to partner with DA, which was the main opposition party. How have they been able to quiet that noise and to reach any compromises if you look at the composition of what they have announced as the cabinet?
Yes, absolutely. There is a lot of unhappiness within ANC circles and ANC partners about getting into bed, so to speak, with the DA and even the Freedom Front Plus, a very conservative party. I think the way the ANC has dealt with that is that the ANC under Ramaphosa has really, in the years before this, been united behind him. His detractors and his enemies and those who would try to undermine him have been ousted. The Ace Magashulas, the Jacob Zumas, those in the party who are unhappy with this don't have enough power to change the direction of things right now. But it is still something that Ramaphosa will have to be aware of, him and his team who kind of keep everyone in line.
Going back to this political angle, I think President Ramaphosa said that the parties forming this government have signed an agreement to adhere to the constitution. Tell us why this is important to do and whether it will help them keep in line and stay to the agreement that they have come to now.
So Ramaphosa and others have been quite strict about sticking to the constitution because there have been so many parties that have campaigned on scrapping the constitution and scrapping key provisions within the constitution that would really destabilize our country. And so I think those parties have seen such rapid growth, especially the MK party, to go from nothing to over 14% in a matter of months shows that there is a real appetite for this kind of populist policies. So I think that was a really important thing to put forward to ensure that people who join respect the constitution, because there are other parties who will say things like, we must reintroduce the death penalty. No, that's against the constitution. You can't do that. You can't just unilaterally say that. So I think that was important to keep everyone centered on one common goal.
And are you confident this government is going to hold together?
I wish I could say for sure that this government will hold together, but politics is such a wild game across the world. I mean, look at what's happening across the world, in Europe, in America, in the UK. Coalition politics are very tricky. In our country, they've not been very successful, quite frankly, at the local level. They've been incredibly unstable, and everyone has had a lot of fear that that would happen again at a national level. But I think the stakes are different at a national level, and I think that there is also moves in progress to make sure that this is more resilient than previous coalitions, making the coalition agreement public, passing legislation that will make coalitions more secure, ensuring that people can't switch back and forth between parties and kick out the person in charge when they feel like it.
South African journalist Virashni Pillay. Now, you may have spotted the hashtag Free Latif in the last few weeks. It's been used by people who are calling for the release from prison of the prominent Ugandan fashion designer Latif Madoy. He was released on the 13th of May, accused of illegally possessing military and police uniforms, and was in jail until he was released on bail a few days ago. The thing is, Latif has links to opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi, aka Bobi Wine. He's designed Bobi Wine's red overalls, which have become his signature look on the campaign trail, combined with a red beret. Latif has also made clothes for celebrities like the late South African reggae icon Lucky Dube and Jamaica's Busy Signal. But since 2005, wearing clothes resembling the military uniform has been illegal in Uganda. And recently, the police also added red berets to a list of prohibited clothing. Now, Latif's arrest coincided with a crackdown, or what the police called intelligence-led operation, on civilians wearing actual or look-alike military and police uniforms. So how is Latif doing after his detention? I've been speaking to him about his experience.
Okay, Latif, thank you for making time to speak with us. Firstly, could you begin by describing what happened to you the day that you were arrested?
It was on the 13th day of May when police and all security operatives came into my school premises right here at Jokolela, Kawanda, in Wakiso district, that is Kasangati Town Council. We see all the security, you know, in camouflage, not in security uniforms, but also like in civilian clothes, coming to the school premises. The gates was open, and they introduced themselves to us as security personnel, looking for A, B, C, D. And I brought in the search warrants, and we complied to that. So we accepted because we knew nothing was happening in our school. We are all straight. So we let them do the job. And what they introduced about the, what they are looking for is they are looking for clothes that resemble like Uganda security uniforms. And well, as you know, fashion is everywhere and people embrace, you know, those camouflage clothes. Oh my goodness, I had just dressed Bobby Wine at his last concert in London with what I call the Freedom Fighters overall, that they interpreted that I was among the pressure group that is fighting or demanding for free Uganda. But the reason why I made the Freedom Fighters overall is about we, the workers, because I know an overall is basically a work wear, you know, and Bobby Wine always preaches and tells the youth especially to work, to find something to do so they can sustain themselves. And we were arrested. I've seen people being removed their nails. I've seen people being broken their ribs. I've seen people losing their, you know, body parts, eyes and everything. And I need all that in my performance. So that's why I was complying in whatever way they wanted me so they could not do any harm.
Were you being disciplined or were you fearing for some of what you are describing, which sounds like torture to me?
Because I've seen it happen before to many, you know, people who are being arrested. And I don't know what's the reason why they reached that point of beating them and almost losing their lives. I grew my hair, my dreadlocks, for many reasons. In a way, you know, to guide me, to protect it, so I wouldn't do anything to lose my hair.
From what we know is that your dreadlocks were cut off and you had been growing them for 17 years.
Yes.
Tell us about that moment and how you felt and how you still feel about it.
Actually, that was the most breaking point. That's when, in the whole event, that's when I shed my tears, feeling heartbroken, like I was feeling a metallic pain on my heart. That's how I felt. I looked at the officer who made the order. I was like, what's happening? What can I do? You know, what can I say? I tried to plead, you know, to seek for assistance, to seek for permission from the OC of the prison. But, you know, he always gave me a deaf ear and also threatening orders, like they would even cut my hair like several times so I cannot, you know, put it back in any way. Basically, that was the most breaking point. I really felt so bad.
Yes. Could you tell us what the significance of the dreadlocks is to you and why you are fighting so hard not to have them cut?
Well, that's a very wonderful question. Because I consider hair or my dreadlocks, I always considered them as my crown. So having, you know, crowned myself with dreadlocks 17 years ago, it was not very easy for me to lose it. Because I know there are many circumstances well, that can lead to the loss of your dreadlocks. It can be an accident, you damage your head. The only way to treat you is by cutting off your hair to get treatment and be healed. And that's the reason that really made me feel strong.
So yes. How have you been feeling about that incident and the arrest and what happened and the cutting of your dreadlocks? Has any of these events had any impact on how you feel, your mental health?
Well, it really hurt me. Every time I think about it, how am I going to appear in people who know me, who usually know me, who always praise me with my dreadlocks? Oh, nice locks. Oh, you look nice with dreadlocks. Oh, you put a different image in the society. We always knew that people with dreadlocks, people were praising me for dreadlocks and relating it to what I do. That really pains me. Now I'm seen like any other common person. That really breaks me. It makes me even feel shy. I can't visit certain places. Maybe I'll even feel shy coming back on stage without my dreadlocks because everybody was relating me, comparing me with Lucky Dube. You know, that it sounds nice. You know, Lucky Dube was a very great artist. And if people can compare you with Lucky Dube, Bob Marley, I mean, you feel you've done something for the society, you know, because everybody's like, what kind of legacy can I leave?
You feel like a big part of your identity has been removed from you.
It's a big part of my identity. But though it doesn't change the heart, that when you lose it, therefore you must act different.
So you've been released. What's your situation now?
Because I'm still reporting at the court. My next reporting will be on 29th of July. We lost our machines. Business is not the same. We were teaching at school, and students have no machines from where they can learn from. So we are depressed in a way. We are depressed in a way, and we basically need some support at least to run business back to normal.
Let me ask then, Latif, did you at any point, or have you at any point in your life seen yourself as a figure in the politics of Uganda, whether it's for government or the opposition? And how will this then affect how you move with your work going forward? Will you, for example, make clothing for opposition figures in the country like Bobi Wine?
I once told myself that even if people would vote me into power or in any political position like MP or mayor, I wouldn't do that. Only if I can still perform the same way I perform. If I can still be a designer in my office, I can have a sewing machine, you know, still do my job. But I want to focus on basically doing my job, because this is what God gave me. I've never interested myself into being a politician, nor in being in any political position. What I'm doing, I'm only doing my job, because my job serves everybody. It serves basically social and political personalities. So designing Bobi Wine, we've grown together even before he thought of doing politics many years ago. From his first song, Kagoma, you know, I've been dressing him at his concerts and also in his video shootings. So the friendship and the relationship that I have with Bobi Wine is not something that you can buy. The relationship that I have with President Museveni is not something you can buy. They only vary in levels that, you know, when you have friends, they are friends you bring home, they are friends you don't bring home. But Bobi Wine, I embraced him because we share the same ideas. And actually, when Bobi Wine came into politics, I was like, oh, I've gotten my speaker, someone who can speak my mind. That's why I take him. But as for me, I'm a costume designer who is not involved in anything like making uniforms. I only design costumes, especially custom-made costumes. So I've never been positioned, you know, seeing myself as a politician.
Latif Madoy, yes. Thank you so much for your time.
You are welcome.
Latif Madoy. So why was Mr. Madoy targeted by the Ugandan police and government? We called on the journalist Tony Musho to unpack this for Focus on Africa.
All right, Tony, start by telling us why Mr. Latif Madoy was arrested in the first place.
Well, it's just political persecution. He's a very, very good designer. He has designed some clothes for the opposition leader here, Robert Chagulanyi. So he's done some clothes for him. I believe the popular overalls, the red overalls that he usually puts on during political events, that's from Latif Madoy. I'm not sure if he made his beret, red beret, but I'm pretty sure that he's the one who did for him the red overalls.
Tell me why you say it's political persecution, because when I spoke to Mr. Madoy, he said he's designed some clothes for Museveni, Yoweri Museveni, the president of Uganda himself, and other political personalities in the country. So why is it that in this instance it's being seen as political persecution, like you said?
It's because when it came out, when this insignia came out, the People Power insignia, the red berets, the red overalls, when they came out, they kind of caught fire. Everyone loved them. Nothing like this had ever happened, you know? There had always been T-shirts, there had always been hats, but when the red beret and the red overalls came out, everyone wanted them. Somehow it just collected all the apolitical people and started making them political. That is how it felt like. It was a big deal. So it is political persecution on the part of Latif Madoy, on the part of the state against Latif Madoy, because this is an insignia that a lot of people warmed up to. And it was a big deal for the young people in Kampala.
The reason also why I'm asking this is because clothing looking like military or police uniforms, the camouflage, were found in his house and his premises. And that is what the police seem to have said is the reason why he was being arrested, because it is illegal to possess or to wear clothing that look like that. Is it not illegal?
They are actually not illegal, but the government gazetted them again to stop this political movement from going forward, you know?
We've asked both the Ugandan government and Ugandan police for a comment, but there's been no response. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Wimbledon 2024.
If you're a tennis fan, then you will no doubt be glued to your radios or TVs over the next 2 weeks because Wimbledon is now underway. And could this be the year that Africa gets its first ever women's champion at the prestigious grass court event? Well, Tunisia's Ons Jabeur has come close, very close in fact. She's reached Wimbledon final for the last 2 years, only to come away as the runner-up both times. This year, she's hoping it will be the third time lucky and her dreams of winning the title will come true. Our very own Nishat Latha managed to get an interview with Ons over the weekend. I caught up with Nishat earlier on, and she started by telling me about Ons and how she rose to the world stage.
She's always been a solid player, and she'd worked her way up the world rankings, but it was just after the pandemic, really, when she burst onto the global scene. And then in 2022, she'd had a fantastic year. She reached number two in the world. That made her the highest ever ranked African singles player, male or female. And she developed into this kind of social phenomenon in Tunisia. Everyone was talking about her across the whole continent, across the whole Arab world. And then when she reached the Wimbledon final in 2022, you wondered if the stars had just aligned for her. Was this going to be her big breakthrough year? Was she going to win a big Grand Slam title? But despite taking the first set against Kazakhstan's Elena Rybakina, Jabeur went on to lose that final in three sets. But, you know, she'd really captured the hearts and minds of the world over. And her love affair with Wimbledon continued into 2023 because she made the final again. And she faced the Czech player Markéta Vondrousova for the title. But this just wasn't Jabeur's day. She lost in straight sets. And it was a really painful defeat. She was in floods of tears. She was famously comforted on court by Catherine, the Princess of Wales. And that meant that it was two consecutive finals and two consecutive defeats. And that pain was really tough to see.
And you've been speaking to her. What is she like?
Oh, she seems to be in really good spirits, Charles. Very bubbly, laughing and joking with reporters, living up to this tag of the Minister of Happiness, which her band of Tunisian fans have given to her. You know, she'd been joking and dancing and taking selfies with other players, including Irina Sabalenka. You know, they've been making headlines because of all their joking on court. She seems really comfortable and at ease. You know, she looks confident going into these championships. But she had admitted that she'd had a panic attack in her warm-up ahead of last year's final. Her breathing had been affected. She said it was perhaps because she wanted this too much, so much so that she'd had a picture on her phone screensaver of the Wimbledon trophy, the Venus Rosewater dish. And then she'd also put pressure on herself because she decided that if she won a Grand Slam title, and the Grand Slam titles are the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon or the US Open, if she won one of those titles, then she could take a break to have a baby. So she had tagged winning Wimbledon last year to also starting a family. And she realised that you really can't always plan life like that when she lost that final. So after that raw emotion of last year, I asked her if she had any negative feelings on her return to the All England Club.
I felt a little bit sad coming here, but obviously Wimbledon is my favourite tournament. I love being here, I love the crowd, I love the amazing court. So hopefully it's just going to bring me so much joy, and really grateful that I have another opportunity to participate at Wimbledon again. And I will take it point by point, set by set, and hopefully match by match.
I have seen firsthand, Ons, how much the Tunisian fans love you when they're here. And the whole Arab world, the whole African world loves you. Does that feel like a responsibility when you come here again?
Yeah, it's a good responsibility, I gotta say. Their love is really important for me. The Tunisian and the Arab community here is really important, and I feel the love also from the whole crowd. It's so great to have this love. I feel fortunate to have all of that, and hopefully I can really do my best and win and make them happy as well.
And the thing is, you've blossomed into a real character on court as well. We love the fun, we love the joy. We've seen you dancing with Sabalenka. Is that important to you?
It is very important. I mean, I love just smiling and having fun, you know. I always say, you know, tennis is such an amazing, you know, sport, but one day we'll stop, and what's left of our memories is just the fun moments that we have, and I try to do that every moment I have.
Now, you do visualize a lot of things. I have to ask you, what is on your screensaver?
Right now, I'm actually having my niece and nephew. They're such a cute age, and I just love their pure energy and just enjoying, you know, having fun with them.
Could it be third time lucky?
Hopefully. That's what I'm hoping for.
That's Ons Jabeur, and she does sound like a very warm, nice personality, Nishat. Third time lucky, you asked her, she thinks so, but we are talking about her now. How much pressure is there on her at this moment?
Charles, I think there's a lot of pressure on her, and it hasn't been a great year for her, really. She's suffered from illness and injury. She's slipped down the rankings. She's suffered early exits at Grand Slams, and she's had a really troublesome knee problem as well. And that's led her to pulling out of the Paris Olympics later this month. She says she wants to protect her health, especially because the Olympics will be played on the clay of Roland Garros. So she'd be going from grass to clay. And that change of surface is really tough on the body. She's going to be 30 next month, and she's slipped number 10 in the world. But, you know, Charles, she loves the Wimbledon grass. She has an affinity with this event, and she opens against Japan's Moyuko Uchijima, who is number 70 in the world. So, yes, there is pressure, but, you know, she should get through that opening game. And when I spoke to her, she had a real twinkle in her eye, and you just never know.
And what about the future of African tennis? Who can we look to challenge for tournament wins alongside Jabeur?
Well, the great thing is that Ons Jabeur isn't the only African name in the Wimbledon draw. Her fellow North African Maya Sharif of Egypt also features, as does South African Lloyd Harris. Now, he's back at Wimbledon after coming through qualifying. He was a top 30 player in his prime, but he's been hampered by injuries and surgeries, and it's great to see him back. For the future, though, let's keep an eye on Kenya's Angela Okutoyi. She became African champion at the African Games in Ghana earlier this year. She is already a Wimbledon Juniors champion. Remember, she won the girls' doubles title a couple of years ago. She's currently in the collegiate system in the United States, but she is a really exciting prospect. As she says, she had very humble beginnings, but she is now a real inspiration for other budding tennis players across the continent, and her future and the future of African tennis looks really bright.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nishat.
Thank you, Charles.
That's Focus on Africa today. This episode was put together by Hebela Hassan, Sunita Naha, and Joseph Kin. Our technical producer was Gabriel O'Regan, and Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Speak again soon.